has to wake up. Oh, okay. There we go. Donna, is there another coaster? I don't want to put this on the nice brocade in case it has... Or even a piece of paper or something. Okay. So good morning. It's such a nice day today. I imagine that some people will be... that might have come had it been raining, might be out taking. Come again?
There's a stream cleanup today.
Oh, so they're doing some good things. Okay, excellent. That's nice. That does have. I know some other centers. People say that has the secondary effect that people think they can stay at home and. Which is true, which is great. So, where they can listen later also, or I understand, is also live, guys? So, I mentioned to a friend of mine up in Boston who had wanted to come. She couldn't come in the end with the family responsibilities and her health. And I gave her the link in Washington, D.C., and she wrote me an email back. Bless your heart.
Sounds like a southerner.
Well, no, she's good. She's in New Jersey. Very opposite of southerner. So let's begin with a little meditation again. Tradition in Buddhism often is to recite prayers at the beginning, but my experience is that unless you have meditated on the meaning of those words, they can just be an exercise in recitation. You know, you can just be saying words and your mind can be somewhere else. It's very interesting, though, if you meditate very carefully on each of the points of the prayer, later when you say that prayer, it can bring up a remembering consciousness of what is meant. Saying those few words can be very powerful. There is a prayer is said, very short prayer to renew your tantric vows every day. Take the tantric vows, renew them. Maybe you know, just four lines. I go for refuge to the three rare supremities or three jewels, however you say. I go for refuge to the three jewels. I confess all negativities individually. I rejoice in the virtues of all migrators. I hold Buddha Bodhi in mind, the enlightenment of Buddha in mind. Have you ever heard that? I don't know how it's translated. It's in some of the tantric rituals when you take the Bodhisattva vows or even in the Bodhisattva ceremonies. Spending time on each of those, you know, really trying to understand what refuge means. Just saying those words brings up that. Then the next one, confess all negativities individually. Remembering, even now, the things you... Understanding, even now, the things you don't remember having done in past lives. Recognizing that there are obstacles in your mind. Feeling remorse for that. Rejoicing the virtues of others, such as... the stories that we're reading here in the Jatakas and these other stories. Holding Buddha Bodhi in mind means generating that thought, I must achieve enlightenment for the sake of others. Just saying those few words, once you have meditated on each and have spent time to break through, so to speak, that those words are actually bringing back some remembering consciousness, it can be very powerful. But I find often, it's worthwhile just doing some meditation at the beginning to set a motivation. So let's sit comfortably. Relax your body. Relatively easy, even for some of us it's difficult, so you can scan your body if you need. feeling some tension, and you know, let the muscles even physically tense a little bit and go beyond that, let them relax if there's some tension in your body. And then place your attention and your mindfulness on the respiration. As you train to concentrate on the breathing, you may be oscillating back between being distracted by thoughts and then coming back to the breathing. That's normal. Try to invest all of that psychic energy into just being aware of the breathing. So that you don't give fuel to the conceptual thoughts in your mind. Augment this breathing now by adding a visualization. As you breathe in, imagine that you're not only breathing in the air, but you're breathing in the blessings of the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas of the Ten Directions, in the form of white light and nectar filling your body. You can even hold the respiration at the end for a second. Imagine that white light burning up all the negativity in your body, in your mind. And as you breathe out, as you exhale, imagine breathing out the remnants of that negativity, like black soot having burned up some fuel, some kind of residue is left. Imagine breathing that out so it has nothing to do with you any longer. Breathe in white light, comforting, relaxing your body, burning up the negativity. First, breathe out the tension in your body. Again, breathe in white light. Breathe out the attachment energy that's burned up by that white light. And the next expiration, the hatred energy. And the ignorance energy. And then follow one breath as though it's going up your nostrils to the crown of your head, down the, just in front of the spine, past your throat, to your heart area, heart chakra. Just leave your attention there. Let go of paying attention to the breathing and focus on the mental consciousness. Like a turtle or a tortoise that has been disturbed and is frightened, pulling in its head and limbs into the shell, imagine withdrawing your attention away from your eye consciousness, almost like bringing that energy down to the heart chakra. Your ear consciousness, nose consciousness, like two other limbs, your tongue and tactile consciousness, like hunkering down into the area around your heart chakra. Just watch the contents of your mind. Notice the moments when it's not full of content. There's a certain kind of ease, even pleasure in that. When thoughts or images come to your mind, withdraw your attention away from them, the same as we withdrew our attention away from the sense consciousnesses. And deprived of your attention, those thoughts or images, even emotions, will begin to subside, disappear. Once the mind is a little bit calmed like that, you can start to sense the spaciousness, the clear light nature of the mind within which the thoughts, the contents are emerging and reabsorbing, disappearing back into that clear light nature of the mind, like clouds on a sunny day, evaporated, just disappearing right where they are. even letting go of some of the contents of the mind, there may still be the appearance of your body to your mind, as though your mind is paying attention to the tactile consciousness, maybe the outline of your body or some particular place where there's some tension, or just the very almost irrefutable, seemingly irrefutable presence of your body. Recognize that too as just an appearance to your mental consciousness, withdraw your attention away from that, back to the subjective mind that's perceiving that image. Let go of the body. On an even more subtle level, there will be a subtle apprehension of the self identity, me, myself, I. Almost like the body, almost like seemingly irrefutable. That's really there. Recognize that too. That appearance of the eye is just an appearance to your mental consciousness. Let go of that. Like turning your back to someone who's up in your face, talking right in your face. Turn away and try to perceive the subject mind, the consciousness that is actually perceiving that sense of I, just the bare awareness, clear and knowing, without the content. If you get a glimpse at that spacious nature of the mind, the clarity, its non-obstructing nature, try to hold it. Elongate the period that you can see it, even if you have to go back to using some logic, you know, turning away from the thoughts or seeing the space between the thoughts. Once you see it, try to keep a continuity, hold that single-pointedly. And recognize even this fleeting appearance of the clarity of your mind is, as of yet, just another appearance to the mind. We haven't really touched barely, directly, the clear light nature of the mind. So let go of that appearance and try to sense the more subtle mind itself. Not just an imagination of it. What we're trying to apprehend here, trying to see, understand, is what's called the conventional clear light nature of the mind. it's within this clear light nature that we can develop all the good qualities, that we can remove all of the faults. This can be called our conventional Buddha nature. Just as the emptiness of this mind is called the actual Buddha potential, Buddha nature. I think that the opportunity to perceive this, to understand and feel empowered by this, that we can develop all of the sacred qualities of the path. We can get rid of all of the faults we have now, our low self-esteem, our pettiness, our ego, grasping. The ability to do this is due to having a life right now of what the Buddha called leisure and endowment, a perfect human rebirth. We could use this life, what's left of it, to find security, to find friendships and success in the world. Or we could use it to practice the Dharma, devoting what time we have left as much as we can without becoming fatigued, because we do need to rest occasionally, dedicating as much of it to the practice of Dharma, overcoming our obsession with the eight worldly dharmas, the eight worldly concerns, developing renunciation, compassion in bodhicitta, the right view of emptiness. What a great way to make use of this time that we have left. I think this morning, this afternoon, the coming talks tomorrow, I'm going to devote that time of my perfect human rebirth, as I've got some quiet conditions, to listening to the teachings on the former lives of the Buddha, the various teachings he gave about karma and rebirth. Not just simply to amass knowledge, but as medicine, as examples that I can follow, that I can rejoice in, on my quest to heal myself for the sake of others, to become a lesser burden for others. And once I'm no longer a burden, when I don't harm them as much as I have in the past, because I've eliminated my anger, hatred, my clinging attachment, then I can actually benefit them in a spiritual way. For that purpose, I'm going to listen to the talks. I'm going to think about them, when I have some insight of the truth of something, try to hold it single-pointedly, meditate on that. Imagining all living beings around us who have, in numberless lifetimes, been our mother. Even our enemies will again be incredibly close and so dear to us in the future, for their benefit, for their aim. I think I'm going to listen to the teachings this morning and this afternoon, tomorrow, to quickly achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all these beings. And then relax. Bring your attention back to the present. Hey, good morning. Well, as I asked yesterday, anyone have any observation or question about meditation? Or anything? Doesn't have to be about. Yes, Susie, do you have a question?
I found that very beneficial, and I'm not a very good person to meditate on things that long and like that. So I'm going to go back
was
over
it
that.
Long? It was like 15
well,
minutes, yeah. Maybe.
For me.
Yeah.
For me it was.
Was
for
it?
Others,
15
no.
minutes or something like that? That was a little
I
bit long,
know.
Though. Sorry about that.
But, you know, a lot of people benefit from that very much, but I'm going to go back over the audio and capture it so that I can use it. Thank you.
Yeah. So if you found that beneficial, the course next weekend will delve into that. What we were watching, trying to observe, is a subtle object called the conventional clear light nature of the mind. You probably have received teachings on this before. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in teaching the Uttara Tantra, one of the great texts, not a tantra text, not like when you see Uttara Tantra, oftentimes when visiting teachers came to Italy, they always wanted the teacher to teach the Uttara Tantra, thinking it was like tantric teachings. Tantra has a different meaning there, Uttara Tantra. It's actually one of the texts taught by Maitreya, the future Buddha. But the nature of the mind, the clear light nature of the mind, Buddha potential, Buddha nature, and everything. When the Dalai Lama was teaching that, he said, I think you can call this conventional clear light nature of the mind the conventional Buddha nature. Generally, do you know what Buddha nature means? Buddha potential? Have you heard that term? Is it okay? Since you nodded, what does it mean? What is Buddha potential?
From my understanding, it's that all sentient beings have the ability to reach enlightenment.
Right, and so that's general. That's what Buddha potential means. What is the Buddha potential? What can be identified? Is it your fingernail or your eye consciousness?
No, I would think it would be more the mind, omniscient mind.
Okay, do we have omniscient mind now?
No.
No, so it's not. Our Buddha potential.
Complete compassion and awareness of how things exist.
What do you think? Good try. The gentleman who came, I don't remember seeing. What, do you, are you an old student? Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
So, what do you know? What would you say Buddha potential is, or Buddha nature? The Buddha nature.
Well, based on my naive understanding, I think Buddha potential means, you know, that to be the ability to be enlightened and to understand the true nature of phenomena.
So you're agreeing with this young lady, more or less, yeah. Okay. So if one were to try to identify what allows you to do that, it's generally what's recognized, especially in the highest philosophical school, say the Majjhimaka school, the Prajnagika school, is the emptiness of the mind. So there, every phenomena has two natures. Its conventional nature, like say this book appears, you know, it has some, within the perception, when you're not meditating on emptiness, it has certain things that appear to the senses, touch and odor and so forth. Every phenomenon also has another nature, its ultimate nature, which is emptiness. The empty, what's said to be the... So what does emptiness mean? Empty. The word that we often... Oh, you're going to answer?
I was going to try.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to try, but you...
There's no inherent book in the book from its own side. It's parts, causes, and conditions, and how our mind perceives it.
Right. And what that actually means in experience is, we can say the words, but the actual experience of emptiness is said to be inexpressible. So, just saying those words can lead us in that direction. What does it mean? I've mentioned before this example. When I was in India once teaching, there was one lady who was a Dharma student. She had gone... She was traveling around, all dirty, and she had her good clothes with her, also in her knapsack. She went to a cheap hotel first to take a shower, to put on her good clothes. Then she went to the Hilton or something in town to have a nice meal. But she had to go to this, just to change into her nice clothes. So she's walking in, she's wearing some nice clothes. She looked out of the corner of her eye. She saw another lady, like in peripheral vision, right, who was in the same dress. I don't know if this is just an archetype, some kind of silly thing, but men generally don't care if another guy is wearing the same clothes. Maybe they do, but some women are more concerned that this person had the same clothes. And so she was surprised. She looked, and she first says, "Looks just like me." And she realized it was her reflection in one of these big glass doors, in the very big hotels, and had been very clean. So she saw her own reflection. At that moment, she realized that the person she thought was there was not there. There was something appearing. It was like you could say that reflection was devoid or empty of the person she thought was there before. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We use the word. Like, if you see a mirage, at first you're not skilled in the ways of the desert or whatever, and you think there's really water there. Once someone explains to you that it is just due to the refraction of the light, or you actually go there and you search, you don't find it through a lot of exercises, you realize that's an illusion. You realize that something's appearing, but it's devoid or empty of some import that your mind was projecting upon it. So those examples that the Buddha gave, like the reflection or mirage and echo and different things, are examples to help us understand, and even in the end, as examples for a logical reason to realize emptiness. So when we say that the conventional phenomena is empty of something, we have to learn over time what that something is. It's not like like in the case of the reflection, one thought there was another person there, or in the case of a deer seeing a reflection of the moon in a pond of water, the deer is fascinated as though it's like there's a real moon down there. So every phenomena has two natures. If the conventional nature of the mind, there are different conventional natures, different natures that the mind has. For instance, impermanence is one of its natures, right? That's a conventional nature. But when we say the conventional clear light nature of the mind, that means it's to the conventional mind that's apprehending, watching the mind, let's say watching your own mind, maybe you can think one part of the mind like a spy looking at the rest of the mind, not looking at the content, letting go of the content, letting it disappear, and just seeing the spaciousness of the mind, what's called its clarity. A basic definition of consciousness is that which is clear and knowing. So knowing is kind of the function of consciousness. Clarity, this the clear light nature, is its conventional, one of its conventional natures, this clarity, the ability for things to emerge within the mind, to absorb back into the mind. Becoming aware of that helps us not to identify with our delusions. You can realize, I'm not anger. You know, I'm not attachments. You can let go of them in an instant. So that clear light nature of the mind, conventional clear light nature of the mind, if you talk about its emptiness, which is always there, the way that it appears, when you're looking at it, you understand a certain profound conventional nature, its clarity, but it still is appearing as something that really is there, like there's a real reflection there. There's a real person behind the reflection. Once you realize the emptiness of the mind, of that clear light nature of the mind, that's called the Buddha potential. That clear light, that emptiness of the mind is what allows the mind to develop all of the qualities, to get rid of all of the faults. So that's what is identified as the actual Buddha nature. Ultimate Buddha nature, you might say. So His Holiness mentioned when he was teaching the Uttara Tantra that you could call this just the mind itself, the clear light nature of the mind, the conventional Buddha nature. Sometimes we differentiate when we talk about Buddha nature, we talk about the developmental Buddha nature, which is kind of the words that you use. The fact that the mind can develop good qualities and eliminate faults, and it's naturally abiding Buddha nature, which is the emptiness of the mind. So this holiness, I think, was alluding to the fact that this conventional clear light nature of the mind was kind of like this developmental Buddha nature. Okay, enough of that. I just wanted to pose that, leave some imprints. Because when we talk in the Mahamudra meditation, we're basically trying to see this conventional clear light nature of the mind, use that to develop concentration rather than concentrating on an image of the Buddha or some other phenomena. There are many things you can use to concentrate on, right? To develop single point of concentration. I'm sure Geshe-la has given teachings. But if you concentrate on this clear light nature of the mind, you can develop concentration very well. And then in that quiet mind, you can meditate on the emptiness of the self, personal selflessness. And then apply that same logic to the clear light nature of the mind. You can realize the emptiness of the mind itself. Yes.
How do you know that you have achieved
For the sake of people who are streaming, thank you.
Yes, Donna.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Very good steward.
How did one know at least that you are progressing towards that goal? Because each time I feel like, you know, you achieve that, then suddenly you realize that you have 10,000 miles to go.
Well, that's there. You were your own guide right there, that you realized you had 10,000 miles more to go. I think what one needs is, first of all, to have heard the teachings. You know, when we talk about the wisdoms that arise from hearing, contemplating, and meditating. Have you heard of that triad, so to speak? Successively more profound kinds of wisdom. Certain kind of understanding comes from hearing the teachings, the resonance of the words, understanding their meaning, and certain understanding arises. But when you contemplate, analyze that in depth, you get a deeper kind of understanding. It's called the wisdom arisen from contemplation. And once you've gotten the taste of that, you've come to some conclusion, oh, that's the real sense here. If you hold that single pointedly, there's a deeper kind of wisdom that arises from that that's called the wisdom arisen from meditation. Here the meditation means a wisdom consciousness that is concentrated on that. So having heard the teachings, contemplated them, and meditating, you have to sometimes get feedback from spiritual guides or other sangha, you know, a spiritual community. There's the external judge, you might say, like say the spiritual guide who can you can tell your experiences to. Oftentimes in meditation courses, like in the Theravada tradition, you have a chance to sit down with the Bhante or the, you know, to ask your questions, and he or she can, you know, say, no, that's not quite right, you have to do this, or to the Tibetan Lama or someone else. But also there's the inner judge from your own observation, seeing whether you are becoming a better person, whether you can keep concentration on something continually. If it seems like there's miles and miles to go, one has to deal with that. Sometimes that can become frustrating. You think, I'm not making any progress. What else do I need to do? So that's where you need to sometimes check with the teachings or a teacher to delineate that more. But as your faith in Buddhism progresses, as your faith in understanding that this is a long process to get out of cyclic existence, one is not so much in a state of angst when you don't make rapid progress. You know, you're making some progress. You're accumulating merit, like the stories of the previous lives of the Buddha. You know, so many lives that, you know, all he seemed to have been doing is helping people and accumulating virtuous karma. Say all he seemed to be doing. You know, it's like not like he was in meditation all the time and waking up with new great realizations. So we have to realize that too, that we have to spend a lot of our energy into accumulating virtuous karma and purifying the obstacles in our mind in order to progress in our meditative experience. So when you reach some impasse, you know, like, oh, I'm not making any progress. Oh, I need to do some practices. Offer the mandala, you know, do prostrations, make offerings to the Buddhas, even water. When I say even water, this is an excellent thing to offer. Vajrasattva meditation to purify negativities, reciting the names of the 35 Buddhas to purify negative karma. Or just engaging in this Bodhisattva's deeds, practicing charity and learning how to do that within an understanding of emptiness. There's no giver, there's no action of giving, there's no actual recipient of the giving, inherently existent. Mm-hmm. Practice morality, keeping the vows, realizing that the Buddha explained about natural negativities, but also gave certain precepts so that people, by keeping, making a vow to observe these precepts, one could accumulate even more merit. Practicing patience is a tough one. Practicing perseverance and concentration and wisdom. So all of those, when alternates between periods when you may be making some spiritual progress, or seeming spiritual progress in your practice, either realizations or ability to be patient and so forth, and other times you are trying to accumulate the resources necessary to make those realizations. So, one has to alternate between them. There's a famous text by Chandrakirti I've mentioned yesterday called the Majjhamaka Avatara. Have you heard of that text?
No.
Umalajukva. It's one of the main commentaries to Nargarjuna. Chandrakirti was, Lama Tsongkhapa asked, who could I rely on as the commentator to explain Nargarjuna's understanding of emptiness? And Manjushri said, you can depend on Chandrakirti. He was a 10th level bodhisattva, 10th bhumi bodhisattva, who came in the world particularly to clarify Nargarjuna's teaching. So, perfect, you know. And so in the monasteries, and in Japan, other countries, Chandrakirti's text is considered to be the apex of the understanding of emptiness. One has to understand some of these great treatises to really understand emptiness. It's not enough just to have a casual understanding of it. So if you have a chance to encourage Geshe-la to teach some of those treatises, you know, sometime it would be very good. So let me leave it there for a second. I'm going to go back to reading, so to get back to our Jataka tales, okay? Is that a little bit, yeah. Okay, so Jataka, if I say Jataka tales, I'm using a Sanskrit word with an English word afterwards. So the Jatakas were the stories or tales of the Buddha's previous lives when he was on the Bodhisattva path, right? So yesterday we talked just about one. I'm going to read another and then go to some of these other books. Paper here. What I decided to mention here. So this particular book is, the title is The Marvelous Companion in English, but this is the actual text by Aryasura that's called the Jataka Mala, the rosary or garland of Jatakas that was one of the main, the six main texts of the Kadampas. Remember I mentioned yesterday the ones that were talking about the extensive deeds of the, between wisdom and methods, talking about the extensive deeds of the Bodhisattvas. So yesterday I read the Ruru Deer, which is the 26th of these 34. And what was still in here? Oh, this is Jataka number 13. 13, do you like that number? I was telling at breakfast, it's one of my favorite numbers. Generally in the world, ordinary people think 13 is unlucky number, right? Like Friday the 13th and things like that. When one does divination, when the die come down to 13, that's considered to be the best for spiritual things, which I think is a very interesting kind of dichotomy, you know, bad for worldly things, but, you know, maybe you'll get a cramped seat on the plane, but then somehow that will give you some patience, you know, some spiritual qualities or something. So it's good for spiritual things. So number 13 here of these 34 is called She Who Drives Men Mad. So I read that when I gave a course in Asheville. This was one of the stories I read at that time. my fourth eye here. I had this last year, I had a bad health year. I had lymphocytic colitis followed by Lyme disease and diplopia. And then I passed a kidney stone. I called it my trifecta. I won the karmic trifecta. And one of the results was I still have some diplopia left. That part is diminishing more slowly. They said the neurological effects of Lyme are the last to go away. The body's more recovered. So I have to put on the glasses sometime. She who drives men mad. And the picture here, although you won't be able to see very well, is of someone noble, obviously, looking up at a lady on the top of a roof. Part you'll know it, you'll recognize it in the story. He's being, obviously, he's a nobleman being driven by someone in his chariot. Okay. So the little aphorism at the beginning says, "The virtuous are always reluctant to follow a low road. Even when sick with heavy sorrow, their constancy allows them to maintain a steady course." It reminds me of Michelle Obama's thing. When others go low, we go high, something like that. You know? The virtuous are always reluctant to follow a low road. Okay, I could make some political statements, but I won't. The Bodhisattva, during his many lives, is striving to benefit beings by means of his special qualities of truthfulness, generosity, tranquility, and wisdom. Once took birth as a king of the Shibis. The Shibi people were, this one comes in other of the Jataka tales too, some, either town or sort of civilization in the past. So what does this mean? Upon the Bodhisattva path, I had mentioned Chandrakirti before and I'd lost the thread of why I was saying that. In Lama Tsongkhapa's commentary to Chandrakirti, after the sixth bhumi, which is the main chapter about wisdom, he talks about the seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth bhumis. You know what that means? The Bodhisattva getting closer to enlightenment. There's said to be 10 bhumis. Once you've realized emptiness directly, 10 stages above that. And then the stage of Buddhahood. And in that, again and again, talking on about what the activities of the Bodhisattvas are on those bhumis, Chandrakirti and Lama Tsongkhapa commented on, again and again, the omniscient mind will even enter into the dreams of those bodhisattvas and remind them that they have not yet achieved enlightenment. They have to go back, just like we were saying, go back to accumulate merit, do purification, and then again meditate on emptiness to go further. So this is what the bodhisattva is doing here. The bodhisattva is taking rebirth again and again within cyclic existence, out of compassion to help people now, but the main aim of helping the people now is to accumulate the ability to have achieved the omniscient mind when you can help spontaneously, continuously, without any effort, effortlessly, perfectly to lead people, out of samsara into enlightenment. So that's the main aim. The temporal aim is to alleviate the sufferings right now. So the Bodhisattva during his many lives is striving to benefit beings by means of the special qualities of truthfulness, generosity, tranquility, and wisdom. Once took birth as a king of the Shibis. Embodying the Dharma and self-discipline, he was able to secure the welfare of his subjects much as a father cares for his children, influencing them to increase their virtuous qualities and to turn away from wrong actions. And so his subjects rejoiced both in this world and the next. I will say something political here. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, when asked about some political situations in the States, he said, the Americans should think right now, we ourselves don't have the collective karma to have the most virtuous leaders. I won't point to anyone in particular, but, you know, just in general. So rather than getting angry or, you know, upset about things, to take some personal responsibility and recognize, in order to rectify that, we have to clean up our own act so that we have the karma to be led by virtuous beings. The king administered justice according to the Dharma, treating both kinsmen and commoner alike. And because the people were encouraged to cultivate right action and to obstruct the path of wrongdoing, a ladder to the heavenly realms gradually came into being. It's sort of metaphorically speaking, right? The path that can lead to higher rebirths was made accessible to people because of the culture and the inspiration of the king. Understanding that the welfare of the world rested in righteousness, the king delighted in the path of Dharma, always acting in accord with the Dharma, not allowing others to violate its precepts. The king thus protected his people. Now it happened that one of the principal townsmen in the capital had a daughter of extraordinary beauty, a maiden so exquisite that she appeared to be a goddess incarnate. The merest glimpse of her made it impossible for any but the truly dispassionate to look away. So powerful were the attractions of her charms, and for this reason, it made it impossible for any but the truly dispassionate to look away, so powerful were the attractions of her charms. And for this reason, her family called her Unmanyati, she who drives men mad, or who intoxicates. I remember one of the centers where I was staying for some time, there was one of the ladies, I think she was the director of one of the centers, she used to mention that she found certain men to be very attractive, and she said, "Oh, eye candy." I'd never heard that expression before. Do you ever?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, Brad Pitt. I like to look at that. It's kind of like eye candy. So this lady, this daughter of this man, a nobleman in the town, was kind of like that for men. Needless to say, her father lost no time in telling the king of his daughter. Well, why is it needless to say? Because in those days, if you had something valuable to curry favor with the king, if your daughter married the king, it was advantage for you. So needless to say, her father lost no time in telling the king of his daughter. "Your Majesty," he said, "the very pearl of womanhood has appeared in your realm. Pray be so kind as to decide whether or not you will accept her as your wife." He didn't say he's my daughter, but... Forthwith, the king ordered a group of Brahmins, his ministers, perhaps well-versed concerning the auspicious marks of women, to visit the maiden and determine her suitability as a wife. So the father of Unmadyanti led the Brahmins to his house where they were to meet with his daughter. Asked to attend on the guests, she began to serve them a meal in the proper manner, but no sooner had the Brahmins beheld her than they lost all control of themselves, as if their eyes and minds had been taken over by strong drink, you know, like intoxicating. You're like, wow. Observing that the Brahmins had lost all interest in the meal and that their modesty and composure were quickly slipping away, the householder dismissed his daughter from view and served the Brahmins himself. Upon leaving the dinner, the Brahmins spoke among themselves. "Her charms enchant like a magic spell. The very sight of her would distract the pure sage striving for wisdom. How much more a young prince who lives in pleasure?" Their prince, who is the Bodhisattva, the Buddha, the previous life of the Buddha. "It would be unwise for the king to see her, much less make her his queen. Her beauty would drive him mad. His interest in his duties, both religious and political, would diminish. No good would come of it, and in the end, his subjects would suffer. So, good advice, maybe. They had the best interests of the king and the country in mind. Having thus made up their minds, they reported to the king. "We've seen the maiden, your majesty. It is true she's attractive and possesses a certain loveliness, but no more. Worse, she has inauspicious marks, foreboding ruin and bad luck." Maybe they were thinking of bad luck in the sense that being so attractive, she would lead him away from his duties. "Your majesty ought not even to see her, much less think to wed her. A bad wife veils the glory and opulence of both families as a cloudy night conceals the moon, obscuring the beauty and symmetry of heaven and earth alike." Oh. "Believing the maiden to be inauspiciously marked and thus unsuitable to his rank, the king lost all desire to possess her. Soon afterwards, the householder married his daughter to an official of the royal court named Abhiparaga, who was very devoted to the king. There was another member of the court, the royal court. Sometime later, the king decided to ride through his capital to observe a religious festival. He drove through the town on his royal chariot." Remember that picture at the beginning? He's riding in a chariot, looking up at a house where there's a lady at the top. "He drove through the town on his royal chariot, delighting in the decorations and excitement. The streets had been sprinkled and cleaned, and the white ground strewn with blossoms of many colors, while dancing, singing, pantomime, and music. Elsewhere there was dancing, singing, pantomime, and music. The scent of flowers mingled with a rich profusion of fragrances, incense, powders, perfumes, ointments, and liquors. Lovely wares were being peddled among the crowds of merry citizens who were dressed in their finest attire." Some religious festival, it doesn't mention which one. "On his ride, the king neared the house of Abhiparaga, to whom this other person had given this beautiful daughter as his wife." So she's married to Abhiparaga. "So the king neared that house. There, Unmatayanti, angry with her sovereign because he had spurned her." She'd learned from her father that the king said, "No, I'm not going to bother with her." He had spurned her because, quote, "of her inauspicious marks indeed." Right? Yeah, right. "She stood atop the flat roof of the house, pretending to be curious to see him. As a flash of lightning illuminates a cloud, so did her presence charge the scene. And she wondered in her heart if this king would be able to remain firm and unshaken by such an inauspicious person as herself." Maybe she's a little bit proud. As she faced him, the king's eyes fell upon her. Now the king was accustomed to the wanton airs of his harem, the harem beauties. He also possessed a modest disposition, great constancy, and a strong sense of shame. Attached to the path of virtue, and thus greatly afraid of the looks of young women attached to others, you know what I mean? So, for instance, the precept of Buddhism is if someone is attached to someone else, either through marriage or because they're the daughter, not yet, you know, so forth, it's considered to create negative karma to become attracted to them or to pursue them. Attached to the path of virtue and thus greatly afraid of the looks of young women attached to others, he was practiced in subduing the senses. But he was no match for the god of love. Powerless to turn away, he gazed at her for a long time. In that little line drawing, I think, Susie, you have a copy. Is it in your copy? You have the line drawing? You can see. So he's kind of looking up at her. I'm not sure what she's doing up there. I think she's either going like this or waving or something. She who drives men mad. Powerless to turn away, he gazed at her for a long time. Is she perhaps the goddess of that house, he thought? Is she an Apsara or a demoness? Or Kalmuda, the lovely wife of the moon? Surely she cannot be human. And Nathi continued to ponder as his chariot drove on. Returning to his palace like one absent-minded, he thought of nothing but her, his firmness of mind utterly destroyed. After a few days, he took his charioteer, Sunanda, aside and asked, whose is the house that is surrounded by a white wall, and who is she whose beauty shines like lightning in a white cloud? Sunanda answered, Your Majesty has a high official by the name of Apiparaga. That is his house, and that woman is his wife. She is the daughter of Kirtitavaba. People call her Unmanyanti, she who drives men mad. Discovering that she was the wife of another, he didn't make the connection yet that this was the lady that he had spurned earlier. Discovering that she was the wife of another plunged the king into despair. Sighing long and deeply, his eyes fixed and unmoving, he said to himself in a low voice, Pardon? Oh, you're laughing. Alas, this creature is named all too well. Remember, she's called she who drives men mad or intoxicates them. For her sweet smile has driven me to distraction. That this weakness of mine concerns the wife of another means I must indeed be mad if only I could forget her. So already, we're just getting into the story, incredible connection with the Buddhist teachings, because, you know, maybe you have heard of the various meditations to subdue attachment. In the Buddhist tradition, one of those meditations is meditating on the decomposition of a corpse. Let's say attachment to another being, whether it be to a member of the opposite sex, or maybe if you were fond of the same gender as yourself, recognizing that this is impermanent, meditating on the decomposition of that body at the time of death, becoming blue and splitting, worms infesting it, finally being devoured by the worms and the elements and just bones lying there, to overcome attachment. The Buddha gave his monks especially these meditations. So sometimes when you hear those meditations, it's couched as though it's just a feature of the female body, as though the Buddha was, what's the correct term, misogynist, you know, hated women or something like that. That's not the case. Also, he would give the same instruction to the nuns to view the male body that way, because for us humans in the desire realm, for those who are intent in virtue, one of the greatest distractions, you can give up maybe fame, you become a monk or nun, you know, worldly power and so forth. But one of the things that still is gnawing is the desire to have relationship, loving relationship, or physical, sexual, sensual relationship. And so the appearance of the opposite sex, the attraction of that, one needs antidotes, meditative antidotes, so that when the Buddha taught about the repulsiveness of the body and so forth, meditating on the, how many impure things, what is it, 27, 34 impure things in the body. Lama Zopa Rinpoche often talks about eye kaka. You know what kaka, it's a child talk for excrement, right? Eye kaka is when you wake up in the morning, there's something in your eye, and it's a ear kaka, nose kaka, even tooth kaka, you know, there's some grime on your teeth, right? To meditate on all of these, the bile within the body is not attractive by itself. Of course, the feces, the urine. Even if you look at the body, if you slice the body with the scalpel of your mind. I have to remind you that I didn't say you should cut up bodies. It's just imagine there's nothing pure within the body. Anything you look at is like, ooh, I don't want to embrace with that. It's only when combined in a certain way with this cover of skin that it looks attractive. So there are many kinds of meditations like that because of this kind of, and we maybe all of us, maybe not all of you, at one time or another had been some heartthrob, you know. Maybe it was John Lennon, maybe it was Brad Pitt, or maybe it was, who is it now, Beyonce, or, you know, what, I don't know what it is for guys now. Or maybe just our own friends, you know, someone that you just distracted you so much from the pursuit of virtue. I must be mad if I only could forget her. Yet she is never far from my thoughts. She rules my mind. Shame has left me. And sleep as well. You can't sleep. If only I could give myself over to thoughts of her graceful features, her eyes, her smile, her beauty. The gong striking to remind me of my royal duties arouses only my wrath. Remember yesterday there was the lady said she was awakened by the drums that were like the alarm clock of the king. So there are other gongs to remind the king of his royal duties, you know, like time to go to the court. And he's like, oh, do you ever have that? You know, like, I have to go to work. Thus was the king's constantly deeply shaken by the power of passionate love. Try as he might to compose his mind or disguise his state, his fixed and staring eyes, his emaciated body and languishing appearance manifested his heart's affliction for all to see. Heartbroken? What's not heartbroken yet? Heartbroken is when you can't get it. What is that state called when you're longing for someone?
Heartsick.
There you go. Heartsick. Apiparaga, who had married her, Apiparaga, the king's officer, a skilled judge of character, soon observed the changed behavior of his sovereign. Discovering the cause and knowing well the excessive power of the god of love, he foresaw evil consequences unless some remedy were found. Since he loved his king, this was a very noble disciple of the king, because the king was seen as a virtuous teacher to them. Since he loved his king, he sought a private audience, and approaching his lord, he said, "During my morning prayers today, O lotus-eyed ruler, a yaksha appeared before me." You know what a yaksha is? It's some kind of spirit. Kind of a, not quite in the, sort of on the sides of not quite up into the god realm. A yaksha appeared to me, saying, "The king has fallen in love with Unmandayanti. How can you ignore it?" And then the yaksha vanished. "Immediately I came to you. If what he said is true, your majesty, why have you remained silent? Do me the favor of taking her as your wife." This is a very, you know, even the minister is a noble being, you know, even willing to give his own wife to the king. King said, "No, that cannot be," he said simply. "And for what reasons?" Rhetorical question he's asking himself. "First, all my merit would be lost. And I am not immortal." I remember reading some other translations of this, so this is a little bit, some subtlety here, you know, why would the king's merit be lost if he took her as his wife? Well, he'd be so obsessed with her, he wouldn't be able to create merit. Maybe by the rising of attachment, that merit that he had already generated in the past would be diminished and so forth. "And I am not immortal," meaning because of losing my merit, the fact that I will die eventually would mean that I wouldn't be able to progress spiritually in the future. Second, my wicked deed would inevitably become known to the public. Why would that be bad? Well, people would have less respect for the king and his teachings, his leading them in virtue. He wouldn't be an example of virtue for them any longer. And finally, when you were separated from your wife, my dear, you know, minister, you would burn with a fire of sorrow, a fire which would consume you as surely as flames consume dry grass. The action you suggest, me taking your wife as my own, would cause distress in both this world and the next. Although the ignorant would accept your offer, the wise would refuse it because of these reasons. Apiparaga replied, "Do not fear, Your Majesty, that you will transgress the teachings of the Dharma. Does not the Dharma tell us to accept all gifts that are offered? Therefore, do me a wrong by rejecting mine." You know, one of the rules of the Sangha, not necessarily one of the vows, but the general rules, is that if people want to make offering, you should accept it. Why? You might say, "Oh, I don't need that." But because you give them the opportunity of creating more merit, more so than if they were to give it to a person that didn't live in ordination. Generally, you create more merit depending on the, like if you make offerings to your parents who were very kind to you, you accumulate incredible merit, much more so than giving to a stranger. Giving to your spiritual guides, your teachers, or to the Sangha also likewise creates more merit. So if you don't accept a gift, you're kind of depriving the laity of that, of their ability to, the symbiotic relationship you have with them, because they're, as they provide food and clothing and necessities to the Sangha, that allows them to create merit. Also, in response to that, the Sangha has responsibility of teaching and giving guidance, giving precepts, you know, the 24-hour precepts and so forth, vows to the laity. There's some stories, sometime one monk would be appointed to be not custodian, but someone who's in charge of, maybe custodian of the monk's possessions. And someone would come with a load of butter in a Tibetan monastery and say, "We would like to offer this to the Sangha," and the person mindlessly would say, "Oh no, we don't need any more butter," depriving them of the merit that they could receive by offering this. And that's considered to be a relatively heavy offense. Does not the Dharma tell us to accept all gifts that are offered? Therefore, you do me a wrong by rejecting mine. You are obstructing my practice of generosity. Nor should you fear damage to your reputation. This is an arrangement purely between the two of us. Nobody else need know of it. Further, this transaction is a favor to me, not a grief. I'm not going to, you know, what harm can come to me when my greatest satisfaction lies in serving my king? I beg of you, quietly go and indulge your love. No harm will come to me. So the king says, "Stop! Cease!" cried the king. Those who are just listening to this now, Donna Cease, I was asking last night whether her name was pronounced Cece, and she said, "No, Cease." And I stopped. "Stop," cried the king. "No more of that wicked reasoning. Your attachment to me prevents you from right understanding. Every gift does not need to be accepted. The man who would give his life for me is my true friend, dearer to me than any kin. Therefore, I must also respect his wife. You do me wrong to entice me so." So for every gift, you know, for instance, to give an alcoholic alcohol is not a proper gift and so forth. "Further, I ask you this. Who can believe that you do not love her or that you do not despair as soon as you, or you will not despair as soon as you have given her up. Apiparaga replied, "You are my master, Lord. I am your slave, along with my wife and children. What law is broken if you act as you please toward your female slave? What matter if I should love her? In fact, for that very reason, I desire to give her to you. He who gives something highly prized receives all he might wish for in this world and exceeding happiness in the next. Therefore, pray take her." There's logic to both. It's just the king's reasoning, because he's on the bodhisattva path. This is not a proper thing for him because it can distract him from his virtue. But still the king refused. "Do not say so. It is impossible. I would rather throw myself on a sharp sword or into a blaze of angry flames that offend against the Dharma. For I have always followed its teachings. Truly, the Dharma is the source of all glory." "Very well," said Abhiparaga. "Since your majesty will not have her because she is my wife, I shall command her to be a whore, available to anyone who craves her. She will be yours for the asking." So he's trying to think some logic, sort of like, I disown her, then you could take her. You won't have that reason to say that you will be disappointing me or something. "Are you mad?" said the king. To abandon your guiltless wife would force me to punish you. It would also begin a chain of events full of grief and sadness for many lifetimes to come. You must stop this. Direct your mind to justice and purity." Apiparaga persisted. Boy, this guy doesn't give up, right? "Whatever the consequences, I shall gladly face them for your happiness. Even though my actions violate the Dharma, draw censure upon me, and destroy my own happiness. No one in the world is more worthy than you to be worshipped, O most mighty ruler of the earth. Like a priest, pray help me to increase my merit. Accept my wife as your offering." The king replied, "I know it is your great affection for me that prompts you to promote my welfare without concern for right or wrong." You know, the stories of, when we talk about stories of guru devotion, whether you have to follow the rules of the guru, you know, the teachings, it's mentioned that if the teacher gives you something you cannot do or that is non-virtuous, you don't have to do that. You shouldn't, and you can explain respectively. One time, the bodhisattva was a disciple, a Brahmin child, disciple of a older Brahmin. There were other disciples, and the Brahmin said, "In times of need, it says in the Vedas that if there are not offerings to the Brahmins can just go out and steal, take." I don't know if that was actually the Vedas or if he was just making that up to test his students. So some of the students went out to steal for the teacher, but the bodhisattva explained that this would be against the Dharma, you know, to violate the Dharma, even though it would be to make an offering to his teacher. Where was I? The king replied, "I know it is your great affection for me that prompts you to promote my welfare without concern for right or wrong." Kind of like, it's wrong. Like the advice of the Brahmin teacher had given his student. It was a test. He was very pleased with the disciple that didn't go out to steal for him. "But such love encourages me to prevent you even all the more. Indifference to the censure of others cannot be condoned." What does that mean? Indifference to the censure of others. One of the reasons that the vows were actually enacted by the Buddha, maybe you know, were because of various activities, like say boys acting like crazy monkeys, you know, running around, young monks, and then the laity would bring it up to the Buddha, almost like criticizing that. The censure of the lay community would be one of the reasons to abandon or make prohibitions for various behaviors, because the laity then would lose respect for the Sangha and therefore they would lose the ability to profit from hearing the teachings. They'd have doubts as people. Just like now, we oftentimes, because of the various sexual improprieties of various teachers, or at least the accusations of them, and, you know, power grabbing and so forth, people can lose their faith in the Dharma, you know, and their practice of it, because the teachers are not as, you know, they think the teachers are not pure. Indifference to the censure of others cannot be condoned. We have to consider important the censure of others if they were to see our behavior as wrong. Look here, whoever neglects a virtue, who ignores both the censure of this world and the consequences to be experienced in the next, wins distrust now and gives up hope for happiness later. One must never take pleasure in what is wrong. The advantages are trifling and uncertain. What does that mean? What advantages? The advantages of the pleasure that you get in doing something wrong now. The harm is great and unquestionable. So many important, you know, examples here. You know, when Song Rinpoche would give us teachings, one of the great lamas, great tantric masters, I think he had become abbot of Ganden when he was 27, much before most monks would ever become Geshe, because he was already a Rinpoche, and he spent many years in tantric practice. When he would give teachings, he would tell many things like this, like parables, stories, because there's so much deep teaching in that. If we hear those, at least some imprint in our mind, how to practice. You know, we hear the technical teachings, but this is kind of giving us examples of how to put them into practice. One must never take pleasure in what is wrong. The advantages are trifling and uncertain. So the pleasure, so we're talking about pleasure, samsaric pleasure. Is that real happiness? Samsaric pleasure? What we call contaminated happiness? Pardon? No, why not? So I forgot your name. What's your name?
Bill.
No,
I think that the samsara pleasure is just, there's nothing to stand on, you know, it's just very fleeting.
Right. So there are two things here. The advantages are trifling and uncertain. So the uncertainty kind of covers the duration. There are various ways of explaining the disadvantages of samsaric happiness. One way is just to recognize that samsaric happiness is what the Buddha called, what kind of suffering? Changeable suffering. Have you heard of that? Suffering of suffering, changeable suffering, all pervasive, compounded suffering. So, a little bit like what Bill is saying, when it's changeable suffering, almost sounds like what's pleasurable now will eventually become unpleasant. Eventually it will change into suffering. But Adiyadeva, one of the great disciple of Nargajuna, one of the chapters of his book, the 400 stanzas, or the Bodhisattva's yogic deeds, there's a good translation by Ruth Sonam of that. I think the second or third chapter of that, I can't remember which, is kind of like the source for explaining about changeable suffering, but the deep meaning. Changeable suffering doesn't mean that the samsaric pleasure, it doesn't mean only that the samsaric pleasure will eventually change into suffering. It means that at the very moment you're experiencing it, it's not real pleasure. One example is given is you're in the sun. I've mentioned before, you know this. If you're in the sun, you feel hot, there's a certain high level of discomfort. You know, by my hands indicating that the discomfort due to cold is sort of non-apparent. If you say, let's sit in a nice cool shade, you sit in the shade, and the suffering of heat begins to diminish because the suffering of cool is going up. While the larger suffering is still going down, you know, say the heat is going down, but the cold, the suffering of cold has not exceeded that yet, we experience that as pleasure or relief. Oh man, that's nice, in the nice cool shade. Once you sat there for an hour in the afternoon and the suffering of coolness gets a little bit larger than the suffering of hot, you suggest, oh, let's go sit in the nice warm sun. And then it just changes. You know, the suffering of cold goes down, the suffering of heat goes up. At first you call that pleasure because it's some relief, but that eventually changes into the other. But explaining both meanings of changeable suffering, both that it eventually changes into the opposite, but at the very moment that you're experiencing it, where's the pleasure? It's only exchanging one suffering with another. There's nothing within cyclic existence. I'm sorry to break your bubble. There's nothing within cyclic existence that gives real pleasure. Real pleasure we could call uncontaminated pleasure, which is experienced by those who have realized emptiness. Dharma happiness, you might say, that remains. It doesn't sort of change like that. So that statement was that it is trifling and uncertain. You know, there's a verse in the Yondin Shugirma. Do any of you recite that? The foundation of all good qualities? The glance meditation there? Chepe mingom dugnel kungi go iten mirum sipe punzuki nemik ritne tarpe dewala dunya champa kepa jingilo. It's something, you could read the translation there, it's something to the effect, chepe mingom. There's no satisfaction in, one finds no satisfaction in experiencing, enjoying samsaric pleasures. Chepe mingom dugnel kungigo. It is a doorway to all suffering. Chepe mingom dugnel kungigo. Yiten mirum.
Samsaric pleasures.
Oh, yeah, let me just finish it. And then you give the translation. Yiten mirum means there's no certainty. There's nothing you can rely on in samsaric pleasures. Therefore, grant me blessing. Having seen the defects of samsaric happiness, give me the inspiration to yearn for the bliss of liberation. How is it in your text there? How is it?
Very close.
Very close. What says,
seeking samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation.
That's the real bliss, the bliss of liberation, the real happiness. So does that mean you have to be liberated? Well, even if you're liberated, can you be liberated which verse is it? Just out of curiosity, which number in the Yondin Shugirma?
Hang on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
If you're just looking at that prayer, it's
the four lines, right?
Yeah.
The fifth one.
So that has these three, it seems like three shortcomings. They are summarizing what are called the six faults of samsaric happiness. Usually we talk about the six, you know, in the long run, the six sufferings? You know what the six sufferings are? I'll put you on the spot. No,
yeah,
sorry.
Brain
stuff. Yeah, brain freeze. Who knows the six sufferings? You know, we talk about the eight sufferings, the six sufferings. What else do we talk about? The three sufferings. What are the six sufferings?
Yeah? Aging,
No, those, that's in the eight sufferings.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Okay, that's eight, yeah. So, what's the first one? Uncertainty? What was it? Yeah?
Oh, I just found it in
Yeah, read it, read it. Yeah, you have to have it so the people can hear it.
Okay, six kinds of sufferings or drawbacks experienced in all states of cyclic existence. That's what you want.
Yeah.
Uncertainty.
Uncertainty.
Being unsatisfied.
Unsatisfied.
Giving up one's body again and again.
Giving up the body again and again.
Repeatedly being conceived.
Taking rebirth again and again.
Repeatedly being high and low.
Rising and falling.
And being friendless.
Having no companion throughout that continues with you to future lives. These are called the six shortcomings of all the realms, but particularly they can be applied to samsaric happiness. So when we talk about chepe mingom, there's no satisfaction. That's talking about the second of those. The second one of that six was there's no satisfaction. You might say, isn't there satisfaction in samsara? Maybe Mick Jagger didn't get any. You remember that one? I can't get no satisfaction. What is that referring to? That's referring to the fact that even when you're experiencing pleasure, samsaric pleasure, you know, one suffering is going down, replaced by another, you're never satisfied to the point that you'll never want that pleasure again. You might think, I've drank enough of, right now my fave drink is Diet Barks root beer with heavy whipping cream. You know, almost like is it for my keto consumption. So it's very keto friendly. But you know, I think, you know, oh, I have one, maybe a second one, right, David, at night. But I'm never, but I'm never satisfied. The next day, it's not like I had enough that I'll never need again. When we talk about there's no satisfaction found in samsaric happiness, it means that no matter what you have, it's like drinking salt water. Maybe just for a moment you feel, okay, but it even sometimes creates more desire for that. Consuming it. So you get some more barks tonight. I'm getting tonight. I got more desire for that.
I counted before.
You counted before. Okay, good. I'm incorrigible that way. So chepe mingom. So that's the first. Dumnel kungigo means it is the samsaric attraction and indulging in samsaric happiness is the doorway of all suffering. So that includes go to the third one first. Yiten mirum, they're unreliable. So unreliable refers to uncertainty, having to give up the body again and again, rising and falling, never having a friend that continues all of that. The second one is the doorway of all suffering. What's the doorway of all suffering? Taking rebirth again and again. From the basic teachings of the Buddha, you might say, that's the having still within your mind the capacity or need to take rebirth again and again is the doorway of all suffering. Because again, you're thrown into that. Almost like you've given up one relationship, you've had bad relationship, and then you think, oh, I need to have another. It's just like, if you think about it, it's the doorway of all, it's never going to be, it'll never satisfy you. It's a doorway of all sorts of new problems. It's unreliable. You know, because of change and so forth and permanence. So the advantages are trifling and uncertain. That's where I started that riff on those words. The harm great and unquestionable if I were to take pleasure in what is wrong. Also consider that the virtuous abhor all pleasures procured at the expense of others. Standing on the ground of right action, I alone bear the cost of my private interests, hoping never to cause pain to anyone else. Apiparaga countered, he's not given up yet, but where is the injustice? Moved by attachment to my lord, I wish to honor him. Every shibi, from town or country would join with me to ask, where is the injustice in this deed? Where is the harm? Be pleased, therefore, to take her, your majesty. Again, the king says, clearly you have my benefit in mind, but stop and think. Who knows the Dharma best? The whole of the Shibis, you, or your king? Now he's kidding. Listen, I know better than you. Hastily, Apiparaga answered, in all matters, you, your majesty, are the most competent judge, equal to Brihaspati, the priest of the gods. I don't know all of the Hindu, the Vedic god names. Brihaspati is like one of the ministers of the gods who is able to judge. Your assiduous study, your great regard for sacred Lord and the inherent wisdom of your mind are all unparalleled. The king replied, this being so, you should not attempt to mislead me. For remember, both the evil and the good of the people depend on the actions of their rulers. And because I am always thinking of the good of my subjects, I shall continue to love the path of the virtuous in accord with my reputation. As cattle follow the leader of the herd in any direction, right or wrong, so will the people imitate their ruler without any scruples. So the leader, if they're virtuous, they should lead in the right way. Consider this as well. If I lack the power to rule myself, how could I lead my people who long for my protection? Thus, in view of the Dharma and my spotless reputation, I can never allow myself to submit to my passion. I am the protector of my subjects, the leader of the herd. Finally, Apiparaga, the king's official, bowed to the king, his hands folded in reverence. Appeased by the constancy of his king, he said, Majesty, your subjects are favored by destiny to have such a ruler, such a guardian king. Love of virtue, so utterly disregarding of pleasure, is seldom seen, even in the groves of the ascetics. When virtue is given as a name to one devoid of virtue, it has a harsh and grating sound. That's happening now in the world. Yeah. As if it were contempt instead of praise. But for you, O great king, the name great is a brilliant ornament. Yet why should I be astonished at your virtues? You who are as full of virtue as the sea is full of jewels. From this story, this is the end, little condensation. From this story, one can see how the virtuous, even when sick with sorrow, desire, because of their long and pure practice of the Dharma and their constancy, are ever disinclined to follow the path of the low-minded. Considering this, one ought to strive to practice the Dharma and to develop constancy. So that's constancy. I remember once at Manjushri Institute in England, we had invited, it was our Tibetan center there, we had invited Achan Cha. Do you know who Achan Cha was? Any of you? Great Theravada teacher who was, Thai, I guess. Was it Thai? And
Achan Cha?
Achan Cha?
Yeah.
Thai, right?
He's in Australia. Isn't he
Achan Brahm? So Achan, many of his disciples, Achan Brahm is in Australia. Then Achan Sumedho was one of his first Western disciples. I think he had been a Marine. He became his translator. Still, I think Achan Sumedho is still alive. So Achan Sumedho brought Achan Cha, he was actually Thai, great old master, to Manjushri. We'd requested, and he gave some teachings. And he was talking about impermanence. And he said, I want you to do something. Get the gardener, or you yourself go out to the garden, pick the most beautiful flower that's just bloomed. Cut it, put it in a bowl of sand, the root, like the stem, so at least so it'll stand up, and put it where you congregate, like we're in the tea room, where you pass it. So very, very interesting. When we would, the first time you look at it, it's in the bowl there, it looks glistening, the little dew on the drops, the petals are still moist and flexible. But every hour you'd come back, you know, every time you went for tea, it would look a little bit, you know, still maybe the leaves started to droop a little, and then the moisture of, there'd be little dry spots becoming yellow, and you know, it would no longer have that glistening of moisture on the surface, and finally it would begin to smell, you know, after 2 days or something, because it wasn't in water, it wasn't in in the earth. Was that telling you to get up? That's my watch just went in there. Every 10 minutes before the hour, it says, almost there, stand up. That was the same time. That must have been someone's Apple Watch. And so that was a very, you know, the samsaric things that were attached to being impermanent. Right? It was Bill, right? Bill was your name. Bill was saying, they're not reliable. They can't be depended upon. When I gave a course at Kopan, Lama Sopa Rinpoche asked me that one time, that's probably the only time I'll ever teach a Kopan course, I gave that example and I had the people do that, and some people drew the flower, gave pictures, and I asked them to have a contest to name the flower, and it was the name I thought was the best name was Constance. You know, like a girl's name, Connie, you know, Constance. Because he was saying constancy. You know, constancy is a virtuous quality, to be consistent, to follow through, not to fall into the low trail in our lives when tempted, to recognize that's a virtue, to give ourselves encouragement, because one has to study these teachings and experience it in your own life. There's nothing within samsara that will give everlasting happiness. Even at the moment you're experiencing it, it's not real happiness. It's just like exchanging one suffering with another. Someone who's a heroin addict, they're about to inject themselves with heroin, and you see there, and you're trying to tell them, no, don't do that. It's not that's going to be real suffering. At that moment, all they can see is the relief. When they first inject, they say, and then at a short time later, a couple hours later, they start to feel, what is it called when you're no longer experiencing?
Withdrawal,
you know? At that moment, they don't see that. We do, and so we can advise them not to do that. So we're going to take a lunch, we'll dedicate some merits and we'll take a lunch break. I think, is that right, 12? Or is 12:30?
12.
Hour and a half is enough, or do you need more? Okay, well, that's what they said. We can change if you need more time, but do you feel comfortable with that? If someone has to go home to get a sandwich or something, it's hour and a half is enough. So let's, again, relax for a moment. Relax your body. Let go of your pen. Relax your mind. See if you can recall, bring back a remembering consciousness of this clear light nature of your mind, and use that memory to again slide into that state. And within that quiet state, recognize that this morning we've created some virtuous imprints. We've exercised our mind, we've contemplated, we've thought about the subjects that were being mentioned. We may have been inspired, developed some virtuous thoughts. We've created virtuous karma simply by the motivation at the beginning to listen to the teachings for the welfare of others. I'm going to make a firm determination, wishing, aspiring that these virtues not ripen in some meaningless way in the future as some trifling samsaric pleasure, but in whatever way they ripen, may they become the cause of my continued spiritual development. In whatever way they ripen, may I be motivated to use that pleasurable occurrence for the benefit of others. If I'm attractive, if I'm wealthy, if I'm famous in the future, if I'm wise, whatever way that ripens, may it not become a cause of pride or arrogance or miserliness, but may I use it for the benefit of others right then and there, continuing my practice of the Bodhisattva deeds, as Shakyamuni did in these Jataka tales, up to and including the state of enlightenment, when I can perfectly enact the welfare of others. May these merits ripen in that way. Thank you very much. So we'll take a little break now until 1:30-ish, and enjoy. It looks like it's nice outside.